Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the extraordinary reopening of self-inflicted wounds by Donald Trump today, who reversed his reluctant acknowledgement that neo-Nazis and white supremacists were responsible for the violence in Charlottesville, to blame what he called the alt-left, reviving his inexplicable compulsion to pander to the far-right fringe of his base for reasons that remain unclear, unless our president is in fact a racist. Anthony McLear, board chair and co-founder of Life After Hate, a nonprofit working to de-radicalize neo-Nazi and white supremacist youth, whose funding grant from the Department of Homeland Security was rescinded by Catherine Gorka, the wife of White House Deputy Sebastian Gorka, who vowed to shut down the DHS's Countering Violent Extremism program and shift funds away from white supremacist domestic terrorism to target American Muslims, along with getting his wife a job. From a former member of WAR, the White Aryan Resistance, we will learn about the mainstreaming of white racism today, away from tattooed skinheads to clean-cut people in suits, such as Richard Spencer, who look like our neighbors. Then we will speak with Michael Greenberger, the founder and director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he teaches courses on counterterrorism and emergency response. He joins us to discuss the shift in focus of Trump's DHS away from the main and well-documented problem of domestic terrorism perpetrated by white supremacists to the imaginary problem of a Muslim invasion and imposition of Sharia law, and the role of alt-right advisors at the highest levels inside the White House pushing this racist and counterproductive agenda. Then finally, we will look into Trump's renewed attacks on the press as he tries to shift blame away from his own failure of moral leadership and speak with Louis Friedland, a professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin, where he directs the Center for Communication and Democracy. He joins us to discuss the right-wing media ecosystem being built by Fox's Murdoch and Sinclair Smith to serve as the Ministry of Truth and Propaganda arm for the Trump administration, and presidential aide David Gergen's remark that Trump can't heal hate in America because he has so much hate in his heart. And joining us now is Anthony McAleer, who's a board chair and co-founder of Life After Hate, a nonprofit working with individuals who wish to leave a life of hate and violence, which also helps organizations grappling with the causes of intolerance and racism. A former organizer for the White Aryan Resistance, WAR, he served as a skinhead recruiter, proprietor of Canadian Liberty Net, and a manager of a racist rock band, Odin's Law. Tony's love for his children led him on a spiritual journey of personal transformation that brought him to a place of compassion and forgiveness. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tony McAleer.
Thank you for having me.
And today, the heads of the Congressional Black Caucus, Hispanic Caucus, and the Asian Caucus, and the Progressive Caucus sent a letter to the White House demanding the dismissal of the top aides, Stephen Bannon, Stephen Miller, and Sebastian Gorka, saying their presence in the White House has emboldened white supremacists. What's extraordinary here is that it turns out that Sebastian Gorka's wife, Catherine, was the person who convinced Homeland Security to deny a grant to your organization that had already been given by the previous administration, the Obama administration. So this obviously affects you personally, but what is your understanding of why your organization, which does so much to de-radicalize neo-Nazis, and by the way, the new funding only came out back in June, where your group was deleted from the list of people who had been previously funded. And of course, 2 months later, we witnessed what we saw in Charlottesville. So it's pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
It's very sort of sadly ironic, and I think there's a reluctance to accept, and you know, people don't like to look at their own stuff, and there's a reluctance to accept that on the domestic terror side, that white supremacists are a big threat, regardless of what DHS and FBI say, because both of their reports identify murders and violent acts by white supremacists post 9/11 as being a very serious. I think they 74 murders since then. So it is a real threat, but there seems to be a desire to focus solely on what they call radical Islamic terror and radical Islamic extremism. I don't like to use that phrase. I use the phrase ISIS or Al-Qaeda inspired, because I think the ideologies really, at the end of the day, have very little to do with true Islam.
Well, the part of the DHS, the counterterrorism part of the DHS that dealt with, it was called Countering Violent Extremism, and your grant was a part of that effort. On the day after Donald Trump won the election, Sebastian Gorka, the husband of Catherine Gorka, said, "I predict with absolute certitude the jettisoning of concepts such as CVE, Countering Violent Extremism." Have you ever figured out why they do not want to deal or recognize or acknowledge domestic terrorism from neo-Nazis, and why they wouldn't want somebody like you and your organization helping to de-radicalize young Americans attracted to this hateful organization?
Well, I think they have a very different view on how to deal with what he calls radical Islam. He's written a book about it, and it doesn't involve community-led efforts. I haven't read the book, but I understand it's a much more aggressive, violent solution to that, and so that's, I guess, sort of the industry that they're from. But you know, if we dial it back a bit, I still believe that within DHS, most of the rank and file and people that we dealt with still, to the very end, fought to get us this grant. But the decision came from above them, and I know recently. George Saleem, who was the head of this was about a community-led countering violent extremism program. And what the FBI and DHS had said in the last 2 years or so, which was a remarkable shift, was that they admitted that they couldn't arrest their way out of this problem, and that in order to really tackle the problem, it had to be attacked on multiple fronts, and they had to look at engaging and empowering groups from within the communities that these things are springing forth from in order to assist them separately from law enforcement. Because there's, as groups like ours or MPAC, which was the other group that lost its funding, on the ISIS Al-Qaeda inspired side, we can get into places that law enforcement can. We can have conversations and have people open up to us in a way that they couldn't do it with law enforcement. And to have the ability to work in those spaces where law enforcement can't go in partnership with law enforcement, we don't have an antagonistic relationship with law enforcement, but we're very clear that we're not an intelligence gathering organization either. But it allows us to approach it from an angle that the current strategy, which isn't working, couldn't get to. And I think it's extremely short-sighted to go back to what we know is a failed option, and that's just try and arrest the way out of the situation.
But it does seem that the president himself cannot get past this idea of assigning blame for what happened in Charlottesville to both sides. He revisited it again after you would think that he was sort of forced into making a more specific denunciation of the white supremacists, neo-Nazis, etc., who showed up and were clearly the cause of the violence. But he then went on about the other groups, what he referred to as the alt-left. So what is it about this denial that's going on there? It's reached a point now where the president has picked at this scab again, and I'm absolutely baffled as to why he's done this and why he keeps insisting that there are other sides to this story, when it's pretty clear, even though there was violence on both sides, it's pretty clear who incited this situation, who showed up in this town, who strutted their stuff, who kept shouting blood and soil, these Nazi terms, and Jews will not replace us, etc. So from your point of view, having been a part of these movements, is the president continuing to signal to the white supremacist community that I'm really not against you?
As a 501c3, I have to be very careful as to what I what I say here, but I think it's important to follow the example of community leaders like the mayor of Charlottesville, like the governor of Virginia, to call this out for what it is, and I can't think of why the president has conducted himself the way that he has. But you know, it's the thing is that I know from experience and from history, this ideology always, if left unchecked, results in violence and murder. Every decade, people are murdered in the name of this ideology. And you know, as a community, I think everyone has to express their disgust. I believe in a very nonviolent way. I don't believe violence is a solution. It only emboldens them. But I'm not sure whether there's a fear of upsetting a base or something like that. But it's what is currently happening clearly doesn't seem to be working for him.
Well, but Osama bin Laden, for example, the founder of Al-Qaeda, he attacked the United States with a view to sparking a wider between his idea of Islam and the infidels. He invited, in effect, George W. Bush had sort of obliged him in many ways by sending Christian troops to Muslim lands, and we know how that worked out. But in general, it's pretty clear that the strategy of this crazy strategy of bin Laden's was to actually provoke or renew a war with what he called the Crusaders. The same ideas infect the white supremacist movement and the neo-Nazis in this country. Dylann Roof shot those worshippers in the church in Charleston to start a race war. Timothy McVeigh, when he blew up the federal building in Oklahoma, did it apparently to start a race war. So their intentions are pretty clear, aren't they? And I don't know whether that was the intention in Charlottesville, but that has been historically their intention.
And that has been historically the rhetoric. And when somebody acts out on it, whether in a moment of unbelievable madness and stupidity and you know, with the murder of Heather and smashing into those people, like I said, that, you know, behind the scenes, behind the soft rhetoric of it's just about white culture and all this nationalism, I know the conversations that are had behind closed doors, and it's far, far darker. And it is about having a race war, and you know, this has been escalating since they had three battles in UC Berkeley. Then it moved up to Portland, and then they chose Charlottesville for the next battle. And each time they're confronted violently, they grow on it. And I know from being in the midst of it and being an organizer of events and having 3,000 people outside a building trying to smash their way in to get at me and my people, the thing that these guys thrive on is conflict and media attention.
Well, just get,
they get, want yeah. to pull people into a greater and greater conflict. This is feeding right into their narrative, and for people who think that violence is the solution, you know, this is escalating, and it's not a surprise to me that someone has finally been murdered in the wake of this violence. But you know, I said to someone the other day, take a map of the United States and the election, and look at the red counties versus the blue counties, and superimpose upon that a heat map of where all the guns are in the United States, and tell me that confronting these people with violence is a good idea. Because I know from having been there, their thirst and capacity for violence is bottomless.
Well, apparently there are more guns in this country than there are people, but half of the guns in this country are owned by 9% of the people.
Right. And they're all in red counties and red states.
Right. So when you just mentioned a minute ago, Tony McAleer, that you were confronted by thousands, they came after you, the white supremacists and the neo-Nazis, because of the work you do with...
No. This was I was involved. This was a meeting that was going to be a meeting with featuring Tom Metzger from White Aryan Resistance here in Vancouver, and it led to the largest anti-racist rally in the history of the province, and
ended up in
smashed windows and battles with police and that kind of thing. So I know what it's like to be that white nationalist provoking seeking attention and provoking conflict. Mm-hmm. It's what we fed upon.
Well, the co-founder of your organization, Life After Hate, Christian Piccolini, said that the white supremacy movement has been growing, but it's also been shape-shifting. It's gone from what we would have considered very open neo-Nazis and skinheads and KKK marching to people who look like our neighbors, our doctors, our teachers, our mechanics. And some of the, there were people photographing the white supremacists in Charlottesville at the university protest on Friday night and on Saturday to try and identify who these people are. And more it's turning out that these are, in fact, your neighborhood accountant, school administrator, teachers even. So what's happening to this movement that it's taken the hoods off and is out there in the open? And as your co-founder said, these are people that look like our neighbors.
Absolutely. And I think there's now two elements, I believe, to this current movement. One is the, because I don't think you'll find too many accountants and dentists were wearing the shields and clubs and the helmets. They were at the torchlight, they were at that thing, but not on the front lines of violence. So there's the traditional sort of thug element of the white nationalist movement that that loves a punch up in a street fight, and is looking for a place to do that. But now there's this sort of other element, and Richard Spencer is someone who sort of has become the face of this new, far more savvy, there's no tattoos, there's no shaved heads, they've got their what they call fashy haircuts. They're very bright, they're often at universities. A lot of them aren't violent at all. They're just as angry, and they're violent online, but not in a physical sense. Some of them are somewhat socially awkward, a bit nerdy, but they found their sense of identity and power and a place to express their rage through online community. And back in the 80s and 90s when I was active, you would go to meetings where people were gathering, and it was kind of secretive. And that presented a rather large barrier to entry. Like, people didn't want to be identified. But with the online thing, you know, you can be like Dylann Roof and just start off with a simple internet query, and you can go down a rabbit hole very quickly, and you can consume the information at the rate that you can consume it, and you can radicalize in weeks or a couple of months, whereas it took much longer before. And I think there's hundreds of thousands of these young people. You know, when you look at Spencer or Milo Yiannopoulos filling up auditoriums and university campuses across the country, that's a whole generational shift with a completely different face, and they actually often have disdain for the thuggery of the skinheads and the tattoos and that type of thing. So there's sort of two faces to that movement, and there's a very normal, you know, what we said, you know, in the time before I left was, you know, what we were doing wasn't very successful. You can't sort of entice mainstream people to follow you with drunkenness, tattoos, and street brawls. So we told people, grow your hair out, don't get tattoos, go to college, go mainstream, dress normal, join the military, get your training, and all of that kind of thing. And 20 years later, that's sort of where the movement has ended up, and it's got a clean-cut college kid face on it, and it's not nearly as threatening to the average person from an aesthetic point of view as it was in the 90s when it was, you know, alcohol-fueled thuggery.
But it's clearly more dangerous. And
absolutely.
And the work that you do, your organization Life After Hate, who lost their funding thanks to Sebastian Gorka and his wife, who are very close, at least Gorka's very close to the president. The president absolutely loves him when he goes on television. And Gorka's wife, for some reason or other, is an advisor to Homeland Security, who cut the funding for your organization. And as far as I can tell, your organization would be the best way to dissuade these young college kids from going down this rabbit hole, as you referred to it, and getting into the romance of deifying Hitler and all of the Nazi paraphernalia and believing in, you know, all this idea that somehow white men are oppressed in this country. How do you continue your work without the kind of support that you were getting from the Department of Homeland Security?
Well, we never ever did receive any funding, so it's not like we've had to scale things back. But we, you know, we're primarily a volunteer organization. There's you know, five or six of us are you know, co-founders. We have 1.5 people as on salary kind of thing. And we do consulting with policymakers and law enforcement. We get involved in research. We've got results of our research project with the Department of Justice coming out at the end of the year. And we do speaking and stuff, and we rely on the donations from ordinary citizens who, if their government won't support it, they feel it's important enough to support it. And we've had a tremendous amount of donation support over the last couple of days as people realize that this threat is very real, and there's nobody out there that's, tackling and working with these neo-Nazis to help them leave that movement. And it really is an important thing, because we've helped hundreds leave so far, and we've got a private Facebook support group that's got 50, 60 people in it now that are, we're supporting, but they're starting to support each other. So it's mm-hmm. it's scalable and sure. self-regenerating, and it's really positive to see it grow organically like that. So,
well, just in closing, Tony McAleer, David Gergen, who served four presidents, just said yesterday that Trump can't heal hate in America because he has so much hate in his heart. Now, I won't ask you to comment on that because you are, as you say, a nonprofit that's supposed to educate, not indoctrinate, and you're doing a very important work in trying to get these young neo-Nazis and white supremacists to see another way of looking at the world and de-radicalizing them. So just in closing, tell us about your personal transformation, because clearly you had hate in your heart, and now it seems that you are redeeming yourself. And I guess it's what Martin Luther King says, that the hate cannot conquer hate. Only love can do that.
Yeah, and what we find is, since the whole thing is driven by shame, what's the antidote to shame? Empathy and compassion. And that was what ultimately changed things for me. And it came in two forms. One was the birth of my daughter and then my son 15 months later. And the beautiful thing about children is they love us unconditionally. And when we're compassionate with another human being, what we do is we hold up a mirror and allow them to see their humanity reflected back at them when they can't see it themselves when they look in the mirror. And my children provided a safe place for me to let the guard down, to drop the shielding that was keeping me disconnected and protected, and what I felt was safe. That got me so far. And then the second piece was with a counselor who I'd met and really connected with, and for my first therapy session with him, I'm telling him about very shamefully the things that I had done and the violence I had committed. And an English guy about 10 years older, and I was born in Liverpool. He was born in Manchester, and we really connected on quirky English things like Monty Python. And he starts smiling at me, and I go, this is odd. I wasn't expecting that. And I go, why are you smiling? And he goes, I was born Jewish, right? So here was this Jewish man who wanted to help me heal, loved me, could see the humanity in me when I couldn't see it. And there I was, someone who had advocated the annihilation of him and his people, and that really began an incredible relationship, but really messed with my head, because I still carried, in his words, I'd left the movement, but the movement hadn't entirely left me. And that compassion from someone whom I didn't feel I deserved it from, the compassion from someone who I had dehumanized, was an incredibly powerful transformational piece. And, I think it's up to us as individuals to look at that practice of compassion. And the hardest thing in the world to do is to have compassion for somebody who has no compassion, but they are exactly the people that need it most.
Well, Anthony McAleer, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Anthony McAleer, who's board chair and co-founder of Life After Hate, a nonprofit working with individuals who wish to leave a life of hate and violence, which also helps organizations grappling with the causes of intolerance and racism. A former organizer for the White Aryan Resistance War, he served as a skinhead recruiter, proprietor of Canadian Liberty Net, and a manager of the racist rock band Odin's Law. Tony's love for his children led him on a spiritual journey of personal transformation that brought him to a place of compassion and forgiveness. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the shift in focus of Trump's DHS away from the main problem of white domestic terrorism to the imaginary problem of a Muslim invasion.